Welcome to Recogs, the Inventory Success Podcast, where we discuss how the top operators source, manufacture, finance, and sell their inventory and create successful businesses. I'm your host, Mike Gelb. I'm the community manager here at Manufactured. Manufactured is the inventory success platform for consumer and B2B companies. What do we mean when we say inventory success? Well, we help SMBs manufacture, finance, and distribute inventory and their products across 20 categories. If you're looking for help to reduce your COGS, or you're looking for inventory financing or selling to new channels, we're happy to see if we can help at manufactured.com. The link is in the show notes. Now, I know this is a free podcast, but I do have an ask. If you're enjoying this show, if you can please subscribe on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you're listening, so you don't miss when the next episode is, that would be amazing. And if you can also leave us a review on the Apple Podcasts app, that'd be fantastic. We also not only produce content devoted towards SMBs and helping them how to think about inventory, but we also throw events to help foster community all around the US and maybe soon Canada. To subscribe and be in the know when we're next to an event, please check out the link in the show notes. Our guest today is Mike Fada, who is one of the co-founders of Manitoba Harvest Hemp Foods. As you can imagine, Manitoba Harvest Hemp Foods produces quality hemp-based foods, oils, and supplements. It was acquired by Tilroy for nine figures, and now he's an investor, a coach, and a writer. We're going to focus this conversation, though, during his time building Manitoba, and especially focusing on the early days when Manitoba was still a small, medium-sized business. So we discuss, how did he break into retail? How did he actually get his first retailer? How did he actually partner with suppliers and built out his supply chain from scratch? When does it make sense to actually push into more retail accounts? And then, oh, by the way, once you're in those accounts, how the heck did he finance that inventory? Without further ado, here's Mike. Mike, thank you so much for coming on this podcast. How are you?
I'm doing well, Mike. Thanks for having me.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure. It's great catching up with you at Expo West. I'd love to start from the very beginning. When did you discover hemp, and what was kind of the aha moment that led you to founding Manitoba Harvest?
I knew about hemp in the early 1990s. I thought hemp was cool, and you know, I thought more of the fiber aspect of hemp, but I learned about the nutritional properties of hemp seed in the late 1990s, and when I was going through my health journey, and that's what led me to founding Manitoba Harvest in 1998.
What's like the health benefits of hemp?
Yeah, it's a very nutritious seed, really rich in plant-based protein compared to other seeds and even other nuts and seeds. But it's also a good source of omega-3 and omega-6 essential fatty acids and some longer chain fatty acids like GLA, gamma linoleic acid. So just a very nutritious protein and fat source.
How did you first think when you discovered hemp and the attributes and qualities and how they were helping you? And you maybe saw them helping other people. When did you think that there was an opportunity here to actually turn it into a business and actually start Manitoba Harvest?
Yeah, it was pretty immediate. And a couple things. I was went on a no-fat diet at that time. Going through my 100-pound weight loss, I experimented with a bunch of fad diets. One of them was the no-fat diet. So I learned the hard way about essential fatty acids. And when I learned that I personally needed essential fats, I was confused on it with about the no-fat, learned how good of a source hemp seed was. And I just thought, you know, there was other products in the market like flax seed, but hemp tasted better. And I thought, you know, that could be the future. People would learn that they needed fat, that they needed a good source of fat, and they wanted a tasty source like hemp hearts.
So how did you first go about finding, when you first started Manitoba, how did you think about sourcing raw ingredients and also just the overall manufacturing? Was it something that you thought you, on the manufacturing side, that you eventually needed to do yourself? Were you contacting manufacturers? What was the kind of like that process?
We learned a lot about, so in Manitoba, there was, it's no longer operational in the same way, but there was a food development center. So it's a government-assisted facility to help food manufacturers, entrepreneurs bring food products to market on a small scale. And there's other resources here too in Manitoba. It's a very rich agriculture city. So the university and the college both have, call it pilot plants, to help, help entrepreneurs. But we worked with the Food Development Center, out of Portage la Prairie, Manitoba, and learned, I really went into it with zero knowledge. All I knew was I was a consumer of products. I hung out in a lot of health food stores. I saw flaxseed oil on the shelf. I had bought some of it and I thought, okay, why don't we just, and I'm a big believer in repurposing with pride. So like, how do we just create a similar product made of hemp and, you know, create a label, get the bottles and all of that. And, I learned all of that, like where to source and get started from the Food Development Center. And they had technical assistance to actually manufacture our first product, but also helped us with a supplier list of who was supplying, you know, bottles and caps and who was supplying labels. And so that's how we really got our start.
And in terms of the actual ingredients, were you sourcing, I mean, I know it's called Manitoba Harvest. Were you actually sourcing like the hemp in Manitoba? Were you also thinking about it on global or?
Our first farmer was in Manitoba, and Manitoba was really the hemp capital of Canada when the industry started in 1998, and we were a driver in that as well. Our first farmer was here. One of our strengths was in our first investment rounds. We brought on 20 farmers and allowed them to invest in the company. And so not only were we vertically integrated, dealing directly with the farmers from a supply standpoint, but one of my strategies was to actually sell them shares in the business so that they felt like an owner, you know, they were an owner and had interest in helping not only supply quality hemp seed, but just try to go a little bit further as a supplier partner. But over time, as we grew the business, you know, all the way up to, you know, $100 million business, we expanded production outside of Manitoba into Alberta, into Saskatchewan, and then even into the U.S. After the U.S. legalized hemp in 2018.
And when you said that the hemp business started or hemp started in Canada in 98, is that because hemp was legalized in Canada in 98? Is that right?
Yeah, 1998 was the first year that we got the lobbying efforts to legalize hemp in Canada started in really 1994, 93, 94, and it became commercially legal to grow hemp in Canada in 1998. And I'd say the lobbying efforts in the U.S. started about the same time, but it took until 2018, it took an extra 20 years, you know, and before the Farm Bill was passed.
That sounds about right. And how, since this was obviously a new market, right? This is the first time that hemp was, you know, legalized, in modern society. How did you think about even pricing your product? Because I know that obviously you were thinking when you had maybe the aha moment, of hemp, oh, hey, like, flaxseed is pretty popular. It's interesting, but hemp tastes better and has, you know, great nutritional content as well. So how was it pricing it against in terms of what flaxseed was? Like, how did you, since you're one of the first companies in producing hemp?
Yeah, you know, I guess it wasn't well thought out. Like, I could tell you that, you know, I dropped out of high school, right? I have a couple credits in high school only, so I didn't have any high school education. So really my first business class was the first day that I became an entrepreneur and we started the business. As it relates to pricing, yeah, now I look at it and you do a more sophisticated approach of like, you know, look at the category, do an audit of the category and what are the category price at. I did a little bit of that. Again, I was buying flaxseed oil at the health food store and I knew that I was trying to sell bottles of hemp oil to the first health food store. And the only way to get the manager, the owner to buy it was be price comparative. So we were price comparative, I would say, to a premium flaxseed oil because flax had been around for so many years. There was like the lower quality and then there's the premium quality. So we priced ourselves kind of at a premium quality to the other product that was already on the market.
How were you able to like kind of convince, since this was a new category, how were you, I know that you said this a little bit in terms of thought of hemp, you wanted kind of distributors to kind of compare you all to to Flax, excuse me. But how did you kind of manage to convince buyers, convince retailers in order to actually carry Manitoba?
Yeah, it stepped up. Like our first retailer was the health food store across the street from my mom's place. And again, I was a shopper in there probably at least once a week, if not a couple times a week. And so I bugged the store manager was the owner of the store. And I bugged him for several weeks after we made our first batch of we only made a couple hundred bottles of oil, hemp oil at the first batch. I bugged him for weeks, like, hey, buy the product. He's like, there's no one's asking for hemp. And I was like, no, trust me, you know, put it on the shelf with flaxseed in the fridge. He's like, I don't get any requests for hemp. And I'm like, man, just give me a chance. You know, he's like, okay, fine. Like I'll take three bottles. And so I brought three bottles to the store and wrote him a little hand invoice. He paid me $22.50, you know, and got the product on the shelf, which then in my savvy marketing techniques, I phoned a couple buddies from the gym that I was working out at and said, like, hey, go to the Canadian Nutrition Center and buy the hemp oil off the shelf. And so a couple of days later, you know, the store owner was pretty happy. Hey, two of the three bottles sold. I'll take another three bottles. That was the first retailer. But, you know, we got our first break and my learning of a consumer first approach. We did our first health trade show, health consumer show in Winnipeg, in our hometown here. A few months after we started the business. And over that weekend, I sold a couple hundred bottles of hemp oil, basically our first whole lot, our first whole batch that we did, by setting up a table and telling people, you know, hey, I used to weigh 300 pounds. I lost a bunch of weight. I went on a no-fat diet myself. I learned how bad it is to cut all the fat out of your diet. And now we're making a essential fatty acid-rich product, hemp oil. Try it. People loved it. And bought the product. We sold out that weekend, but not only did we sell out that weekend, one of the owners of the health food chain, the largest health food chain in Manitoba, was exhibiting at the show, and everyone was going over to his booth after they bought a bottle of hemp oil and was like, hey, you got to sell this in the store. So he came to me, actually John Holtman, and after the show and said, hey, a bunch of my customers want your product. I want to have you in the store. So, I mean, that was our first kind of start. We went from one health food store. He had a chain of seven health food stores. And thankfully, John became a mentor of mine and also, you know, helped to pitch us to the first distributor. Because by the time that we were pitching distributors, we had the retailers already. We had a handful or a couple handfuls of retailers that we were giving to the distributor. So, you know, Purity Life was our first distributor in Canada. But we said, hey, look, we got these 20 health food stores that we're selling direct to. We'll give you that business and then let's drive into more of your stores that you guys sell to.
Got it. Got it. So you're almost doing the distributor a favor, essentially, since you're already in the stores.
Yeah, you have to. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Making friends with the distributor by saying we're bringing you business. That's how serious we are. Right. Like that guerrilla marketing approach or that bottoms up approach, like, it's hard. Yes. But I still think 25 years later that strategy works today compared to, you know, the top down approach is really, really expensive. If you just go in and try to convince a distributor to sell your products, and then you have to go in and hire a broker, and then that broker's going out to sell to all the stores, like, yeah, at some point you'll scale, thankfully, hopefully, to that stage of business. But if you start out that way, it could literally cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars. Where do you get that money from? We didn't have that money, you know, so we had to go the other way and, like, get the stores first. And I tell entrepreneurs this today, it's the 10-10-100 approach to business. If you can sell to the 10 stores that are within 10 kilometers, 10 miles from your house and get your first 100 customers in each one of those stores, you're way more set up than to do something with that business, bring on your first distributor, or, like, you have some volume to work with, you know, you've proven it out a bit.
How also did you approach, as well as too, when you bring on a distributor too, that's going to cut into your margins as well, right? So how did you also approach when you were you obviously were in retailers, and now you're bringing on or Purity Life is kind of bringing you on into the fold, and you're bringing them on in terms of the retailers. How did you then think about? Did you ever have to, like, restructure in terms of your pricing or even think about or think about your margin profile a little bit differently?
Thankfully, that first product, because I had priced our hemp oil at kind of premium to flax. Yeah, when we went from selling direct to retailers to distributors, we took a 25-27 point margin cut. But we never changed the pricing, actually. We and this is a part of being vertically integrated that really helped the business out, is the more volume we did it really helped with our margin improvement. And so we were able to combat that. That said, though, like other products that we produce, as we produced hemp hearts and then hemp protein powders and some of our other products, I was more mindful at that point to make sure that we had a tremendous amount of margin. Like, I'm a big believer in a 50% plus gross margin after your discounts and trade spend. And so I started to price things accordingly. And so we never really had any, you know, we had a little minor price increases over the years, Mike, but our scale and our growth always allowed us to maintain really strong gross margins, even though our input costs were going up with inflation and kind of otherwise.
That's amazing. That's amazing that you're able to kind of already bet that out. I'd imagine also, since you had your the farmers also invested in the company as shareholders, that maybe might have been helpful by saying, hey, listen, like, this is growing. We now have to maybe take on and take points, but like, this is working. But you know, could you maybe help us or at the same time?
Yeah, that didn't really come into play. Having farmers as shareholders helped us with surety of supply, but it didn't help us with pricing. Like, the cost of hemp seed constantly went up because, you know, their price of fuel and stuff went up. So when we started the business, the price of hemp seed was about 50 cents a pound for hemp seed, not organic hemp seed, but hemp seeds, you know, grown without pesticides, which was our program with the farmers. But by the time over 20 years that we grew the business, the price of hemp seed went up to, you know, upwards of like 80 cents a pound. And organic was priced at like $1.80 to $2 a pound. So the price of hemp seed went up dramatically. But, you know, as we scaled up, we got a lot better at manufacturing and extraction and less waste into our yield. And then our cost of labor and overhead portion of manufacturing got a lot more efficient at scale. And so again, we were able to maintain that really, really healthy gross margin because even though we had inflation of costs, we had all these levers to pull versus with volume that allowed us to stay at 50%.
No, that's really helpful. How also did you approach like the inventory planning side? Because of course you're kind of growing, it seems, at a clip. You're bringing in a distributor, getting to more stores. What was your kind of approach for, first of all, like inventory planning in terms of lead time and making sure you had enough inventory to actually be able to satisfy that demand or be on shelf at all those stores? And then secondly, how did you think about replenishment? When did it actually make sense in terms of to think about how much to manufacture and when to manufacture it at a ongoing rate?
Yeah, I think about this like the farmer's market approach, because that's really how we started, and we were manufacturing. So, you know, the first run we did 250 bottles of hemp oil. Then we made a run of 500 bottles. Then we got up to doing 1,000 bottle runs. So I always say to entrepreneurs, if you could look at, you know, what's your minimum run quantity to get the right yield, you know, it's a little bit different if you're manufacturing. Sometimes if you're just co-packed, it's harder because you have these larger minimum order quantities. But if you kind of think about it like minimum order quantity, and by the time we got up to say like 2,000 units at a time, then it was like, okay, we're just doing that 2,000 units instead of once a month, every 2 weeks. And now we're doing a run of 2,000 units every week. And now we're doing a run of 2,000 units a couple times a week, you know, and then before we started to like, oh, we need to do 3 or 4 or 5,000 units at a time. Like ultimately at the end, when we were a $100 million business, we were making 4 truckloads a day of product out of our facility. But when it just started in year one, year two, we were making like a half a pallet or one pallet, you know, once a week or once every kind of 2 weeks is what we needed to do. And sorry, Mike, and it wasn't sophisticated, right? It was like, we ran on QuickBooks in the business until we were, $5 or $6 million company. So we use spreadsheets, you know, and just a simple Excel sheet that showed what our bill of materials was, what that run of 1,000 units of product was going to take to get in ingredients. I guess, you know, I was conscious of how much component parts did we really need so that we could grow and not run into a wall, like bottles and labels and bags for hemp seeds. But a lot of that the focus wasn't on best price right off the bat. It was on vendors that were in our local market here that could service us efficiently and quickly. And that helped us solve kind of problems if we did have any constraints.
And how many SKUs did you launch with?
I mean, we launched with one SKU. Hemp oil was our only product at first, and we had one SKU. And then we created hemp seeds, shelled hemp seeds, which became hemp hearts, which we had, our second SKU. And then we had a couple versions. We had a couple sizes of oil and seeds. And so I think we were up to 4 or 5 SKUs. But shortly after we launched in the U.S. So then we had to keep Canadian labels and U.S. labels. All of a sudden we doubled it. We went from like 5 to 10 SKUs. And then the business had, you know, at scale, had a good 50 SKUs that were high performing SKUs, like basically hemp hearts in every size from single serve to a 5 pound bag of it, or, you know, even 200 pound drums and totes. Cause we were selling also to other food manufacturers as an ingredient. It started out really, really small, and I'm a big believer in that, right? You don't want to too wide, too fast in CPG is a death kiss, you know, whether that's too many products too fast or too many retailers too wide too fast. You want to have a best in class single product that sells, the velocity is really high, and best in category, and that should be the focus at first, you know. And it's hard to do that if you get distracted with too many SKUs.
Totally. So at what point in the business did you actually expand, going from like one SKU, let's say, to actually introducing like the hemp seed oil? If you're able to give like maybe a rough like revenue range, or even as far along in terms of years that you
did. Yeah, it was like a year. Our first product, we did one product for a year. Like hemp oil was our product for 1 year, and that first year we did like 50,000-60,000 in sales. The second year we did like 150,000 in sales, but we added hemp seed kind of the second year. I've learned now, listen, the success in this business is $1 million SKUs and $10 million categories. Okay. It's really hard to be successful if you're selling underneath that. So I get too many founders that come to me nowadays and say, "Hey, I built my business to $1 million." And I ask, "Well, what's that $1 million made of?" And they're all proud. They say, "Well, we have 10 SKUs and we're selling to 1,000 retailers." I'm like, "That's horrible. Like, sorry, you know, but what did you build there? You built like a lot of small sales on products, small sales in customers. And it's hard to expand, you know, compared to, I'm wearing the cap today, Midday Squares. They're just doing such a phenomenal example. Like MDS had $1 million on their first bar, right? Their first original bar, and then a couple $1 million in that SKU, and then started to move on. So, you know, you really want to think about when you launch a new product. And we got to this place after having a larger team and we were a larger business, like, can this new product become a $1 million SKU? And can it do that within 24 months of a launch? And really, that's the winning kind of recipe. But if you're starting out, you know, if you have a SKU that's $100,000, you should probably more focus on getting that SKU up to like 200,000, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000, or ideally that $1 million target before you go and start creating too many other SKUs.
Yeah, I mean, I tried Midday Square's new bar at
the Crunchy Peanut.
Yeah, at Expo West. Honestly, it's my favorite of all the ones so far.
It's a big number two for me. Like cookie dough has my heart, but I think Crunchy Peanut will go to number two. It's amazing product, you know. But just look at, you know, what for the team, how well they've done there. Like the 4 SKUs that they had before that, and they're north of a $20 million business, right? So the SKU performance is very strong. Also, their retail performance is really strong. Like they are the best-selling refrigerated snacks in the category because they focused on the turns and the velocity in the retail partners that they have instead of expanding to too many retailers too fast. So I use them as an example over and over again of like done a launch really, really right. You know, they've only been 5 years in business. They did it better than I did it when I was launching for my first 5 years in business, you know. It's a good example to follow. Just go narrow and go deep. Don't go wide and shallow in CPG.
In terms of velocities, and obviously you want to be, you know, one of the best performing in your category. How did you approach when you would get into a new retail chain, for example, making sure that you had velocities that you thought were right? And also, what was kind of successful to you? Was it like, I don't know, like top 20% or top 30% in your category? It was what was kind of like the metrics when it came to velocities that you were kind of focused on?
Yeah, it's hard when you're small, right? When you're starting out, because you're not buying you're not buying data, so you don't have access. Like in the end, we bought Spins and Nielsen and IRI data, so we knew exactly what we were selling across all these retailers. But when you start out, it's hard, which is why I say, you know, a local approach to start also has that benefit, because if you're selling to retailers that are like 10 miles from your house, 10 kilometers from your house, you can make friends in those stores, and then you ask the buyer, you know, what is that category selling? Because it's different in every category. If you're in a super seed like hemp and flax, or you're selling bars, or you're selling a beverage, but understanding what is a good velocity. And if they say, hey, you know, a good velocity in the category is 8 units per week per store, my strategy then became, I wanted to be a category leader. So I wanted to sell 20% more than the category. So if someone's selling like 8 units per week per store is their expectation, my target would be 10 for our team, right? And before we moved on to a next retailer, generally, like, let's get the sales up to 10. Because here's the thing, if the category is at expectation is 8 and you're selling 10, that retailer is going to tell all their retailer friends, like, oh my God, I discovered this great product and look how well it's doing in my store. You'll always, always, always be able to expand distribution. But here's the thing, if that expectation is 8, and a lot of entrepreneurs don't even know, because they don't even ask what the expectation is. So they're blind. They don't know it's 8, but they're only selling 2 or 3 and they go and expand to another retail store. Well, guess what happens? You're just waiting like a couple months until the category review happens. And that buyer is going to say, no, that's only selling 2 to 3. My expectation is 8. I'm going to cut it out and give some other product a shot. And those founders don't even know, right? They don't see it coming. So you have to have an understanding of the category that you're in. What is the expectation of velocity? And then do better than that, ideally.
Yeah. I mean, once you get into the store, that's really when like the real work begins, right? You think that it's like, oh, great. Like, you know, obviously we just got this, you know, PO and, you know, we got paid, you know, maybe after 90 days, but we got paid or we'll be getting paid. But really like the goal is repeat. You want that retailer to kind of come back and be like, oh yeah, I'm definitely going to do another buy this next quarter or monthly or however they buy. And so it's really actually making sure that it's merchandised correctly and obviously leading to kind of sales as well. Any thoughts or tips when it came to actually driving velocities in store that kind of you use?
Yeah, you have to determine what the minimum viable community is for your product. Generally at each stage of business that you're at, but you could take that all the way down to a store level. So I'll give you an example on hemp hearts. Okay. Our half pound bag of hemp hearts was our best-selling product. It had 8 servings in there. Generally people bought that, consumers that eat hemp hearts bought one of those bags once a week. Okay. So each customer that we had in that store was worth 1 unit a week of velocity. And so it's a lot easier, I found, to say, hey, if our target is to sell 10 units per week per store, we need 10 customers in that store that are buying it on a regular basis. And then it's a lot easier to say, or maybe that number might be 20, it might be 30, okay, for different products, but it's a lot easier than to say, now, how are we going to get at those 10 or 20 customers in the store and introduce them to our brand and product, convert them, and then hold on to them? Because that's the real work. Like, the retailer is not going to do that work. The retailer is giving you space on the shelf. And yes, you need to make sure that your pricing and your promotion and your merchandising is right to satisfy sales. But at the end of the day, we're a consumer business. We have to know, how many consumers do we need to go into that store on a regular basis that are consuming our product on a regular basis to buy the product to hit the velocity? And to get a little deeper than that, you want people that buy it at regular price, you know, or at least enough people that buy it at regular, one person that buys it at regular price for someone that buys it on deal. Because that's the other thing that happens is for a lot of new brands, when you go in the store, you only sell on deal, right? People don't really, don't buy it at regular price until you get a a faithful customer, faithful consumer for that store. But that's how I like to think about it, you know, is break it down to usage of your product and purchases per week by a consumer. And then how many consumers do you need to drive that velocity?
One of the other tough things, I mean, obviously seems like a million tough things when it comes to building a consumer business. But one of them also is financing the inventory too, right? Like, because obviously you get paid out, not like, you know, right at the point of sale, you're paying out obviously net 90 terms or what have you. For Manitoba, how did you think about actually financing like the inventory side of it? Was it, hey, we're going to use debt? Was it, hey, we got cash, we're going to use cash? Like what, we're going to raise, you know, rounds of equity in order to finance the inventory? How did you think about the overall financing inventory to make sure you were all kind of good and clear when it came to working capital?
Yeah, it's different at different stages of the business. At first it was when I first started to like realize, and it probably got to, you know, I had to be it was the third or fourth year in business. So we were already probably at $250,000, $250,000 in sales. But I started to realize that every sale that we did, increase the need of cash that we had, right? As you mentioned, the working capital, like you sell, especially when you're selling to a distributor and to a retailer, every sale you make, your receivables go out longer. And generally, the more volume you have, the more inventory you need to service that customer base. And so, you know, people think like, hey, we're just going to get the business off the ground and then it could generate its own cash. Some businesses, yes. Some industries, yes. Consumer packaged goods business, generally, no, you know? And so, it was about, I'm a finance minded, you know, and so I put a lot of effort into writing our budget and rewriting our budget and rewriting our forecast as we got more inputs and insights in on a monthly and quarterly for sure, but even monthly basis. And so I had a good understanding from what our sales expectation was to, you know, what's on the income statement to on the balance sheet, like how much inventory and receivables are we going to have to finance? And what does that look like for cash flow? So, you know, I see too many entrepreneurs that run out of cash. Why? Because they get into the, what I'll call the CPG valley of death. They get new distribution. That new distribution, they don't realize is not going to be profitable for probably 18 to 24 months, but they keep stacking new distribution and new distribution, bigger receivables, bigger inventory needs, and they go into this CPG valley of death. And if they, it's hard to come out the other side if you don't have enough cash and you run out of cash. And we're even seeing it in times like this. Great businesses run out of cash, you fail, right? So determining the right amount of cash flow you need is really all in your your scenario planning of your budget of how much sales and how many days on hand of inventory are you going to need, how many days on hand of receivables are you going to need, and make sure that you have enough cash there. And I like to think about it as like 12 months of cash runway, you know, especially when you're growing a business, like not have enough money for the next couple months, you know, have enough to act your budget or your growth plan over the next 12 months. And then do that in a way that's reasonable to the business with the right amount of like when you're starting out, you need equity. If you start out and you start putting debt onto a business before you kind of proven concept, really dangerous. So you need a certain amount of working capital equity that you need to start the business. After the business gets a little bit more mature, then you can say, okay, how much can we get a line of credit to finance some of those receivables and inventory? There's either through a traditional bank or through an asset-backed lender, you could usually get, you know, 50 or 75% of your receivables and inventory covered. But you always need a certain amount of equity to balance that. You don't want to be too leveraged, because again, in times like this, when interest rates go super high and equity dollars, investment dollars get a little more scarce, you could run out of a runway like that.
No, totally. I mean, especially if there's, you know, personal guarantees and those types of things, then stuff can get, you know, really scary, right?
Yeah. But at scale, I realized this, that we would, and because we were manufacturing as well, is that we would take long-term debt dollars to fund our facility and actually buy pieces of equipment. And we had some great programs by the Canadian government to support lower interest loans to do that. We would use our equity dollars for sales and marketing activities to drive new distribution and get new consumers into the business. And then we would use an operating line of credit to fund our inventory and receivable growth. So we used kind of all three of those facilities to finance the business after we got to you know, millions of dollars in annual revenue, and we had a right scale for the business.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Why did you make the decision? I know you obviously had, you know, the farmers as like, as stakeholders, but I know that you vertically integrated. Why did you kind of make the decision to actually, you know, spend CapEx, to actually, have your own manufacturing plant, for Manitoba Harvest? Why did that make sense versus?
There was no comments for, I mean, that's the thing about, yes, we had to do it. There's starting a new industry. I mean, we tried, like, and I guess to your point, like, our first run of hemp seed oil, we didn't press it. We had a third party that had a oil press and filter press it for us. And so I had the cost of what our first 200 liter barrel of oil cost us, right? 50 gallon drum of hemp seed oil. But it wouldn't have been sustainable to do that in the business. And really not too many people wanted to take the risk on hemp. And so that combined with, you know, there's a lot of support here again in Manitoba to help bring agriculture food products to market. And so we started at the Food Development Center, where we were renting those pieces of equipment. We were renting an oil press. We were renting a filtering unit. We were renting a bottling and labeling machine once a week or once every 2 weeks to do our run of products. And then it was a financial decision after that. I could see and say, hey, you know, I tell the story, our first $25,000 that we raised in equity in the business, we spent $23,000 of it on an oil press, and because we needed it to grow to the next stage of business, and then I realized, oh, you know, being in manufacturing is very capital intensive, and so we had to have that financing strategy, which ultimately was, you know, some of these government guaranteed or interest free or government loans and some grants. So I started to be really hungry and seek those out, because we ultimately got $10 million of long term debt, low interest debt, and over $2 million of grants over the years to finance the business.
My last question for you is, what do you value more, $100 of COGS or $100 cash?
If you've priced it right and you have a 50% margin, then your $100 of COGS is worth $200 of revenue, at least, you know. Because it takes cash to make cash, right? And if you have the right margin structure, you can get on a roll. Like I told people, like it took 10 years for us to become profitable at Manitoba Harvest. 10 years, right? That we had to raise equity dollars over those years to become profitable, which it took $10 million of revenue is what we hit at 10 years. That's when the business had the right scale to be profitable. After that, though, because we had a 50% margin, like we got up to making like a 20% EBITDA on the business. Like when we were doing $50 million in revenue, we had almost $10 million of EBITDA. And so, you know, it that's the beautiful thing, and that's why I'm so bullish on manufacturing. Not only can you, it's expensive to CapEx, and it's expensive, and you need expertise to operate it, but it gives you multiple revenue streams. Because you could sell your brand, you could sell private label, you could sell industrial or food service, but it also gives you these levers that you could pull to increase your gross margin, usually due to efficiency and labor and overhead, that you generally, it's really hard to get that efficiency from a co-man.
Mike, thanks again, man. Really appreciate it. Let me know when you're next in LA, all right?
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, we need to have an LA party of some sort, so...
And there you have it. Mike, thanks so much for coming on the show. If you're enjoying this show, we have a favor. If you can please subscribe on whichever channel you're listening on, whether that's YouTube, Apple, or Spotify, that'd be amazing. If you could also leave us a review on the Apple Podcast app, that'd be phenomenal. And again, we throw events, so check out in the show notes to subscribe to our events newsletter, and you'll be the first to receive and be in the know when we're throwing an event, hopefully near you. Thanks for listening. I hope this was helpful.